The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. These are tumultuous times in the world, politically and economically, but we remain focused on covering what we cover, the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more, all of which is still going on, despite everything you might think and read in the news. And we have a great show covering the culture for you this week. We're going to talk to contributor Lonnie Gonzalez about a Minecraft movie, which has completely exploded all previous ideas of what movie going and entertainment should be. It's a crazy phenomenon. It's like rock and roll for kids, basically. I guess there's always been rock and roll for kids, but this is something like Rocky Horror for kids, really. It's absolutely bananas. We're also going to talk to contributor Sharon Bain about the Trump administration's recent cuts to federal museum and library funding and how that's affecting small institutions around the country. It's very important stuff that we're going to discuss. And I'm also going to have film critic Stephen Garrett on to remember and appreciate the work of the actor Val Kilmer, who died last week at age 65. But first, there's nothing more important in contemporary pop culture than a Minecraft movie, and we're going to talk about it right after this.
As a child, I yearned for the mines.
Who are you?
I am Steve.
What the heck?
In this world, anything you can imagine is possible.
I don't know if you noticed, but the financial news was pretty dire over the last week, unless you were one of the producers of a Minecraft movie, which filled movie theaters around the world with screaming youth. It's like the Beatles came back to life or something. It's the videos I've been seeing from the screenings of a Minecraft movie are insane. And we had a writer, a reviewer. Someone writes for us who has young children. She took them to see a Minecraft movie this weekend. Lonnie Gonzalez is here with me today to talk about a Minecraft movie. Hello, Lonnie.
Hi, Neil.
Hi. So, okay, a Minecraft movie, right? Like when I first started hearing talk about this thing about a week ago, and early reviewers were like, "This is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. It's an absolute disaster." And then suddenly, it was like Prince had come back to life and was touring with Elvis or something. I mean, the insane reception this thing has gotten. Was that your experience when you went to see it?
Well, my theater was a little more subdued. It was a 4 o'clock showing on Friday. So, you know, it wasn't the wild reactions. But, you know, I think it's funny how there's been a lot of surprise that it made money or made so much money. Which right. seemed like a foregone conclusion to me as soon as the preview came out.
Right.
And then you look at the calendar and you see that there hasn't been a movie that, you know, is kind of aimed in this demographic for a lot of weeks. I mean, you know, a movie that kids can really go to.
Right.
And the same thing happened with Super Mario Brothers 2 years ago. So I was like, this is going to be the next Super Mario Brothers. The difference is that Minecraft is actually the most popular game in the world now. You know, it's not a nostalgic thing. It's like at this moment.
And has been for
it has been, yeah.
for a long time. My son is 22 now, but he played Minecraft when he was a kid, and he and his friends haven't seen it yet. They're not like the first line of viewers, but he's like, I'll see that.
Yeah, so even people that are kind of like former gamers on Minecraft are still like young, you know? So it's like exciting, kind of the youth of America and the world, and they're bringing energy to the theater.
Which is something that, as we've talked about a lot on the show, the theater has lacked.
Yeah.
there's this kind of dour movies are dead vibe.
Yeah, the recent kind of big tentpole movies that have come out, like the Captain America Brave New World or the Snow White live action movie, I just didn't feel that it, I didn't know anybody who was excited to see those.
No, I didn't see Snow White.
Yeah, I mean, like, why bother?
Right, oh, right, exactly. I didn't see Snow White, and I did see Captain America just because I'm a Marvel completist, but I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Right, there's an obligation. It wasn't like, I really want to go see this.
Right, it was a professional obligation just to keep track of the narrative. And I'm not going to see a Minecraft movie either because I'm an old man, and I have no particular skin in the game. But I do appreciate, I appreciate the enthusiasm. And in fact, I remember watching. I didn't go see the Super Mario Brothers movie either, although I know you did.
Yes.
probably more times than you wanted to, but I appreciated seeing a video of like enthusiastic grade school kids sing at some event, like singing the Peaches song, the Oscar nominated yes. Peaches song, singing it with just like incredible fervor, like it was like it was the national anthem or something. it gives me hope. Okay, that said, I read your review. And it doesn't sound like a Minecraft movie is particularly good.
No, I mean, like the title says, it is a Minecraft movie. But I would not say it was the best Minecraft movie they could have created, for sure.
Right.
And if you're not planning on seeing it, if you have no interest in Minecraft, then there's no reason for you to see it. The Minecraft stuff is kind of just Jack Black shouting out references or things being paraded across the screen. And, the characters point at it. They mention it. The crowd goes wild and then it moves on. It has nothing to do with the story. And I was kind of disappointed, actually, because I know that Minecraft is a game about creation. And they keep saying this is a world of imagination and creativity. But you don't really see the characters actually get to use their creativity to build things. It all happens off screen, and then they'll just show up and they're like, oh, did you build this? And someone says, yes, I did. And then they move on.
Right. Well, that's what I remember being fun about Minecraft is that you're stuck in a situation, but you can use the environment to create something really imaginative to either, immerse yourself in a fantasy world or just get out of a bad spot. And they don't do that?
Not really. A lot of the stuff that they use, I mean, there is a plot of, they're fighting against this evil pig queen, Malgosha from the Nether. And like these things are all like mentioned, but not too much explained. And then, when it's time to fight, they just grab a shovel. They didn't make the shovel. They just like grab one. Or Jack Black gives them a bunch of stuff that he already made in the, decades that he's been living in the Minecraft world.
The other world. Is it called?
The overworld.
The overworld.
The overworld. Okay. Yeah.
You and I play trivia together and I need to know.
Yes, exactly. I did keep saying otherworld and I had to look it up to make sure I was getting it right. But these new characters, and you've got good actors, and Jason Momoa and Jack Black are being funny. They're in it to be silly and they are all in. And Danielle Brooks is there, who is an Oscar nominee, a great actress, given nothing to do. And then the couple of young actors who I don't really blame them, they just have nothing to work with. But the other thing that I find strange about this movie is you have the Minecraft section, but then you have a section that's set in the real world, in quotation marks, where all these human characters come from. And this movie is directed by Jared Hess, who, people would know Napoleon Dynamite, Nacho Libre. He has a very specific aesthetic. It's set in Idaho, which is where he is from. Really? And where he sets his movies. And everything is sort of like 1980s kitsch.
That is so strange. That is so strange.
It's very strange because it is set in current, like present day, because people have smartphones, but then they're also like are wearing windsuit tracksuits and fanny packs and stuff. So I spent most of the first half hour of the movie just kind of staring with my mouth a little bit open, like in confusion. Like, why is this happening?
I would never, if you'd asked me to guess 1,000 aesthetics that the present day Minecraft movie would take, the vibe of Napoleon Dynamite would be low on the list, very low on the list.
And I can't say that it really works. I personally don't like those movies. I don't find them very funny. Beyond, again, it's just like presenting references or presenting something retro and then expecting you to laugh at it. And then also just presenting things like people are bilingual and like that's supposed to be just a joke. Like people saying things in Spanish is a joke. And I'm like, that's not really a joke. You need more there.
It sounds more like reality to me. But I just, does Jared Hess get this movie because he's friends with Jack Black? I mean, why this guy?
You know, and it's very weird too, because he hasn't really made a movie in a while, almost 10 years. I think the last movie he made, which was called like Don Verdeen, nobody even saw.
Yeah.
I don't think. I did see one quote about like a producer saying like they were the one who thought to bring in Jared Hess, and they were all patting themselves on the back like this was, you know, a brilliant decision and it paid off and that's why Minecraft is so popular. And I'm like, I think it succeeded despite that.
Right. It's not like bringing in Lord Miller for the Lego movie, which was sort of the first movie like this that, the first IP movie to really, break out because of its creativity. But, what can you say, though? I mean, it's, Jack Black, man, that guy really has managed to span the generation gap. And, because he's a Gen X cultural figure.
Sure.
And here's the thing, like, Lonnie, I interviewed Jack Black for some magazine. It must have been like 15 years ago now, and he had little kids then.
Yeah.
So it's not like he himself is particularly like a young Minecraft dad or something.
Right.
He's just an eternal child.
Yeah. I don't really begrudge him for doing the movie. I think he's found a niche, doing like Kung Fu Panda. He was in the Super Mario Brothers. He's in this. He's just somebody who's always funny. And so I kind of feel like, if he's in it, at least I'm going to probably laugh at him.
Yeah, I mean, and he is just like an unstoppable ball of kinetic energy.
Yeah, he's somehow doing not enough and way too much at the same time throughout the movie.
Yeah. All right. Well, you have done an excellent job of turning a cinephile's critical eye on a Minecraft movie.
Thank you. I can't help it. I can't help it start to analyze.
I know it's genetic. But at the same time, we have to just kind of look at this as like beyond a movie, right? This is some kind of like, deep-seated cultural phenomenon that we can't control.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, you can review it, but people are still going to go see it. It's not going to turn anyone away. And, if people are enjoying themselves at the movies, at least I can take some comfort in that. I got my kids to sit through a whole movie and afterwards they said they liked it.
Oh my.
So this is big for me.
It's big. It's big for an adult these days to sit through a whole movie and say they liked it.
Not a YouTube video of other people playing Minecraft. So this is an improvement already.
That is a very good point. And that's just pretty much for young people who like, you see a lot about how, people under the age of, 15 can't absorb a full narrative anymore.
Yeah.
I guess this is the kind of narrative that they can absorb.
Put it on the poster.
Well, no, Hollywood needs to take note of that. If they want to keep making movies and making money, making movies. I mean, not every movie can be like this
We don't want it to, but for sure, make something that a kid will enjoy and you're going to get a whole family into the theater and it's going to make money.
All right. A Minecraft movie has made money. That's for damn.
It has made money.
That is for damn sure.
Absolutely.
And some of that money belonged to Lonnie Gonzalez. And she no longer belongs to her. Now it belongs to the studio. She reviewed a Minecraft movie for us. So Lonnie, go out and go make something out of something.
All right, I will. Thanks, y'all.
I was texting Book and Film Globe contributor and my friend Sharon Vane over the weekend saying, you know, I kind of miss when the Democrats are in power and we can all sort of walk around in a haze pretending that everything's okay, even if it isn't. So as someone who is, I went to journalism school and I, you know, trained as a reporter. So these are times of, there's lots of news. And so it's invigorating and interesting in a certain sense. On the other hand, it's, things are weird and unsettling. And Sharon is here today to talk to me about another thing that is, we never thought we'd have to talk about. Hello, Sharon.
Hello. Good to be here. Although, as seems to be usual for my segment, it's for a disappointing reason to be charitable about it.
It's what Spy Magazine used to call boring but important.
Absolutely right. Very important.
Very important. So our topic today, and this is what Sharon wrote about on Book and Film Globe this week, is museums, specifically, you know, changes to museum culture and museum funding, more importantly, museum funding cuts under the Trump administration. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, as part of this wholesale sweep to make government more efficient, or at least that's the stated reason, the latest victim of cuts has been the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is an agency you've probably never heard of, but which provides a lot of federal funding to state libraries and museums in all 50 states. And they've essentially shut down the agency in the middle of providing grants to these organizations, which provide a lot of important services. And understandably, the museums and the libraries and the people who support them are upset about it and pushing back.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously they're pushing back, but I guess, you know, the stated reason is budget cuts. But whatever the agency is called, the IMLS, cannot, you know, be but a fraction of, let's say, the Defense Department budget, right? Like, so what do you think is really behind these cuts? I mean, are they really, how much money are they, do they say they're saving? And is it really about saving money?
Well, I think the, I don't have the exact figure, but it is hundredths of a percent of the total federal budget. So you're right. It's not really about the money. If you look at the executive orders that took this action, there's a lot of conversation around this view of America. We're going to return to when we all felt patriotic. We are going to promote American exceptionalism and cultivate love of country in future generations. There's a lot of targeting of anything that smacks of anything that would involve racial differences, gender fluidity. Of course, DEI is the bad word, or the bad acronym, more accurately, in government. And we see this in who's been targeted. The Smithsonian's Museum of African American History has been charged with promoting hatred of, you know, quote unquote, white culture. They've told the National Museum of the American Woman that you can't have trans women in the exhibits. So there are those high profile things. And then, as we talk about in the story, there's a lot of museums just doing basic museum work that are falling prey to this cancellation.
Well, that is of more interest to me. You know, these sort of internecine culture war disputes. I feel like that kind of stuff is going to fade over time. Like, I don't know if you've been to the Museum of African American History in D.C., but I mean, I can't foresee any scenario in which that gets changed substantially or gets closed substantially. It is just like, you know, perhaps the best museum I've ever been to. And, you know, they're forcing them to change some words and some exhibits. That's one thing. But, you know, the what you focus on in your story is like, it's basically just like a small museum in Wisconsin, right? That is your sort of, that's where you kind of chose to kind of concentrate your lens, right? Maybe tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Sure. Well, one of the things I was interested in finding out is if you're not a Smithsonian or another national museum that gets a lot of attention, how does this act affect you? And so I talked with folks at the Madison Children's Museum in the capital city of Madison, Wisconsin. And there's a lot going on. They've received over the past 10 years over $1 million in grants from IMLS. And some of the things they've done with it are things that it's just hard to see as a problem. They launched this multi-museum initiative called Caretakers of Wonder that's designed for kids who are 8 and younger. And yes, it is aimed at getting them to understand climate change, but they do not mention climate change. There's no, you have to rise up and fight against climate change. It is very basic. Here are the seasons. Here are the animals. Getting them to appreciate being stewards of the world around them. It's hard to argue with that, at least from where I sit. It is hard to argue that that is of huge value to the community that the Madison Children's Museum serves. And yet that's the kind of funding that's going away.
Right, right. Well, there's a quote that's really struck me where they talk, where the director or the person who's in charge of the exhibit talks about how they don't mention climate change because that would just scare kids. It would not be appropriate.
Right. These are not people sitting around trying to push an agenda down someone's throat. I mean, he mentioned specifically, it's just not developmentally a good approach for kids 8 and younger to be talking about that. And so they are doing things within the museum to make it more climate friendly. There's many aspects to this project that's quite interesting. Actually, it's hyperlinked in the story if folks want to dig in more. But the point here is that no one is driving some wacky agenda down these unsuspecting children's throats. They're needing this funding to help educate kids about the world around them in fun, play-based ways. That is what children's museums are all about. And it's hard to think about this just giant swath movement from the federal government just saying, get rid of it all.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll sort it out later. Hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard to argue against teaching kids to love animals and nature. I mean, that just, it seems to be sort of a staple of childhood.
Correct. Right. And so, you know, I think the high profile things that have come out of these actions are the things like asking the Interior Department to revisit all the renaming of the statues of and monuments that have happened since the summer of 2020. Those kind of, I think some people would say you could argue both sides. Other people would say, do we need to revive shrines to the Confederacy? I personally don't think so. But this whole push to reshape arts and the humanities, this is just the latest. We've talked before, written before about cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts. There's National Endowment for the Humanities grants being cut. They're just running willy-nilly through these frameworks that were set up to support culture and arts under the umbrella of getting rid of things that are anti-American. And that is such a slippery slope.
It is. I agree. I agree. I mean, it feels censorial. And if Book and Film Globe has any central thesis, it's that censorship is bad. So yes, I am not down with cutting the arts, funding to the arts and humanities. It just boggles the mind as to what America is going to look like with a sort of diminished arts infrastructure. I will say that, I mean, you have to admit that the arts and the humanities are pretty much the provenance of liberals and the left, right? Like that is, this is something I've been struggling with ever since Trump was re-inaugurated, which is, you know, how can you have like a National Endowment for the Arts or a Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts when 95% of the people involved in arts institutions despise the government as it currently stands? So I understand that like the government is taking a lot of power, but it's taking whatever resources it has to sort of fight back in the culture war. So I think that it's just sad to me that places like the Madison Children's Museum are getting caught in a crossfire.
Well, I think I would argue that, I mean, I think you're right. I think generally speaking, folks who are involved in the arts and cultural institutions tend to be more liberal-minded, most likely, unless it's like that, you know, dinosaur creation museum in Kentucky, right, which is, you know, an unusual
example. Like, see Noah's Ark. I'm like, well, that's not really possible since it's a myth.
Correct. But I mean, what I would argue is, if your government and your sense of country is so fragile that it can't handle an art exhibit or someone's poem spoken on stage at the Kennedy Center, you do not have a very strong sense of government power or the backing of a lot of Americans, because if what you need to do is just take your flamethrower to anyone evidencing any sort of dissent as to what the world is like, it doesn't speak well for your personal sense of security and rightness. If you have to get rid of all of your opponents, you can't even handle some words or some exhibits. It just seems
right.
It would be silly if it wasn't so awful.
Agreed. I will say that liberals and Democrats never have to do that because the arts are so heavily lean in their favor. But it is true that, like, they are not the ones cutting down taking the axe. You know, they're not the ones manning the flamethrower. So, like, again, I just feel like, you know, I find myself missing that sort of, like, the haze of the Obama years where we were all floating along on a magic carpet of
democracy,
of, yes, the art, of the arts and humanities. You know, we could just all kind of comfortably, like, nestle in that and feeling like they weren't under assault in the macro sense. So, but this is the world we live in. You know, we can't deny it, and I feel like, you know, that's we have to kind of keep an eye on it.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's important because all of a sudden people will turn around and these things, not all of them, but a lot of them will be gone or less than, and people will be wondering, well, what happened here? And it's because we ripped out some of the supports we had for a robust world of arts. And instead, it sounds like we're turning it into just kind of an America first worldview, and that's who will get the funding. So we shall see. I'm sure there are ripple effects still to be heard and seen, and lots more to come, no doubt.
Meanwhile, go to a museum this weekend. Who knows how many more chances you'll get?
Absolutely. You've got to support the arts while you can.
All right. Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you.
It's been a rough year for cool Hollywood people dying. We've paid tribute to David Lynch on this program. We paid tribute to Gene Hackman, and we suffered another big loss in the last week. The actor Val Kilmer died. He had, at age 65, he'd been quite ill for a long time. So although he's perhaps a little younger than your median age, I don't think anyone was shocked, but they were still pretty sad. And, you know, people of a certain age considered Val Kilmer to be one of our most eccentric and greatest screen actors, and I'm no exception to that. And I've got Stephen Garrett on the horn. We're going to talk about Val Kilmer.
Hello.
Yeah. So you're obviously, you know, as a lover of movies, you got to love Val Kilmer.
Yeah, I have love for Val Kilmer. I don't know if he was like one of our greatest actors. He certainly was a very, very much more talented actor than most movie stars are. He right. actually had the chops in a way that few didn't. He also turned down a lot of, or rather tried to get cast in eccentric roles that handsome movie stars don't necessarily get cast for.
Yeah, he was an interesting actor, right? Like his, you know, I when you saw what people were sort of remembering him for over the last few days, you know, people are like talking about his performance in, you know, Tombstone, for instance, you know, which is hardly considered like, you know, one of the great movies of all time, but like his performance as Doc Holliday was pretty iconic in that.
I have to confess, I've never seen Tombstone.
Oh, well, I mean, it's like, yeah. You know.
But I trust you.
Yeah, I mean, he's very good, and he's very charismatic. You know, and he was a Batman.
He was a Batman. He was a Jim Morrison. Maybe he was the Jim Morrison. Maybe he was Jim Morrison.
He was definitely, He was Jim Morrison. But yeah, Jim Morrison was alive until this week. He was amazing as Jim Morrison in Oliver Stone's The Doors. Completely embodied that character. And of course he was in the original Top Gun.
Iceman.
He was Iceman, and Tom Cruise brought him back for an elegiac final scene in Top Gun Maverick, which was very sweet, I thought.
That was very lovely. That was really lovely.
Very well done. So, that's sort of the last anyone really got a look at him on screen. So, there's just a lot to remember. But what I found most interesting, Stephen, about the sort of end of Val Kilmer is how much people loved and revered his first two movies.
Yeah.
there was real Genius, in which he played an extremely eccentric college graduate scientist who still lived on campus for some reason.
He was like a hip nerd. He was like the hippest nerd.
And my personal favorite movie of all time starred Val Kilmer. I know you laugh, but I love Top Secret. I love it. I love it.
It's a great movie. I told somebody that you and I were going to be talking about Val Kilmer, and he said, "Are you guys going to be talking about Top Secret?" And I was like, "I think we're only going to talk about Top Secret."
Pretty much, because to me, Top Secret is just a perfect movie comedy, even more so than the Zucker Brothers' other great movies, Airplane and The Naked Gun.
Hey now,
I'm telling you, Top Secret is it's perfect because it is a parody of movie genres that were themselves like not even that popular.
Well, Elvis movies were pretty popular and war movies,
I guess,
right?
Yeah. There was a parody of like Elvis movies, spy movies, and World War II movies. But this was in 1984 that they released this movie. When Airplane came out, the airport movies were pretty recently in the rearview mirror. The Naked Gun kind of Police Squad occupied sort of a similar territory as Top Secret. But okay, we're not really debating what the best Zucker Brothers movie was. It wasn't Dracula Dead and Loving It.
That was Mel Brooks.
Right. So it definitely wasn't that.
It wasn't Rat Race, but that wasn't the full Zazz, right?
Right.
Wasn't
but the point is, the point is Val Kilmer made his debut in Top Secret, and he plays Nick Rivers, who is basically Elvis, but he also records his first big hit is like a Beach Boy style surf song called Skeet Surfin', which plays over the opening credits of the movie. And he's not in that song. He's just singing in the background. And it's just a montage of, people riding surfboards and shooting at skeets in the sky and accidentally shooting down airplanes. And, there's like women in bikinis running around. It's great. It's just so hilarious. But, Nick Rivers is Elvis. And I'll be goddamned if young Val Kilmer, he's 23. Doesn't embody Elvis Presley in this movie, right?
Yeah.
In a comedic way, like a satire of Elvis. He's perfect in it.
Yeah, he's a smart actor. It's funny, there was an appreciation by David Zucker that ran in the Hollywood Reporter this week, where he was like, yeah, I don't think he really liked this movie, but he was amazing in it, which just goes to show you that he was savvy enough to figure out the exact type of irony, comedy, seriousness, self-seriousness. Like, there are a lot of unexpected shades and nuances in his performance that don't necessarily need to be there, which is, I think, why the movie works so well, of course.
It's what distinguishes, to me, Top Secret from, sort of later movie parodies like the Scary Movie movies and all those other hack movies, is that you just get a lot of people kind of mugging for the screen.
Right. And he's acting in the screen.
He's acting. He winks at the screen a number of times in an Elvis way.
Right. Right.
But he never for a moment breaks character, which is something that you can't really say about Leslie Nielsen in The Naked Gun. I mean, God bless him, but Val Kilmer, if you had to say who's a better actor, Val Kilmer or Leslie Nielsen, Val Kilmer, his performance in Top Secret was just the beginning of a pretty good run for a Hollywood actor, I think. It stopped at a certain point because he was, kind of a Malibu eccentric, right?
He certainly was by the 90s, right? Like by the time he's doing Island of Dr. Moreau, which he agrees to do because he wants to work with Brando. And then Brando, according to that documentary Val that came out a few years ago, which was very touching. But Brando apparently was kind of checked out on that and even had a body double do a lot of the scenes because, of course, he's covered in like white suntan lotion and dark glasses and a big hat, and he's wearing kind of a caftan. So it could be Brando or it could be a stunt double. We don't know. And I think he was really disappointed by that. He also talked in that documentary about how when he made Batman, Batman Forever, whichever one it was, that he felt really isolated in that suit, quite literally, because he could not turn his neck. And the rubberized design of it was such that he couldn't really hear people very well. He couldn't turn around and look at people easily without turning his entire body. And so he kind of started to shut down and didn't really care. And nobody, and people stopped talking to him on the set, like making small talk because he couldn't really hear them and engage. And he felt like, well, this is a metaphor for me in Hollywood. Like I can't make movies in a way that's enjoyable for me or fulfilling for me. And every time I try to, it never quite works out. I feel like The Doors is one of those movies that kind of everything aligns, right? Like this is a role that he seems perfectly suited for. He acts the hell out of and completely, you know, kind of reincarnates Jim Morrison. But it's Oliver Stone doing his Oliver Stone kind of thing, which is very eccentric, but also very intelligent and also a little crazy. And that kind of is Val in a nutshell.
Yeah, it fits Val Kilmer. Well, basically, like, the thing is, like, he made enough money, I'm assuming, that he didn't need to keep going if he didn't want to. But it also, it's just kind of this, it's a strange career in that it just sort of stops. But it stops because, A, he was a reluctant eccentric, and B, he got sick.
Right. Well, there's that too, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was interesting. New York Magazine had a remembrance from Will Forte. And I did not remember that, I guess, Val Kilmer was in the MacGruber movie. I didn't remember it because I didn't see it. I remember watching it as a sketch and thought that was fun. I didn't really want to invest 2 hours in watching a movie. Anyway, Val Kilmer was in it. Will Forte was absolutely shocked that Val Kilmer was willing to do it. And there was a point when Val Kilmer was in between houses or something, and he said, hey, can I crash at your place? And Will Forte thought it was for a couple days, and it ended up being like 3 months. And so he was like roommates with Val Kilmer. And he said he was the most delightful, wonderful, sweet, charming, humble, eccentric guy you've ever met. And it was really delightful. Like, and this is, I would imagine, right before the cancer hit. I don't quite know when that happened, but this couldn't have been more than 15 years ago. So maybe cancer hit, 10 years ago, something like that?
Right. All right. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, it makes me want to go back and watch the MacGruber movie. Why not?
Just to get a little more Val.
I mean, I like MacGruber's funny. Why not? But it can't possibly be as funny as Top Secret. And so, you know, for me, when Val Kilmer died, that's all I really, because I see Top Secret at least once a year. I went to the movie theater last year. I went to the Alamo Drafthouse on a Saturday morning, and I watched Top Secret.
I would go any time of day if they were playing in a movie theater. I would love. Was there a good audience for it?
Yeah, there was 20 people. I mean, what do you want for a Saturday morning screening?
At least 20 people. That's great. Yeah. Enough people to laugh.
Oh yeah. It was. if you're going to see that movie on a Saturday morning, 40 years after its release, you're gonna laugh.
You're gonna laugh hard.
You're gonna. I don't think there were a lot of first timers there. It's kind of like my Rocky Horror in a lot of ways. Like I watched some scenes from Top Secret this week because I was, you know, I wrote about the movie and I wrote about Val Kilmer, but I didn't need to. I watched them anyway. Like if I'm feeling depressed, I'll just turn on a song from Top Secret.
Oh, that's a good strategy.
So for me, like, yeah, I like some of Val Kilmer's other movies, but Top Secret just means so much to me as a person. I don't know exactly why. It just hits me like it's like a four quadrant movie for me.
Val Kilmer is like deja vu. You're never going to forget him.
I'll miss him most of all, Scarecrow. All right. Val Kilmer, RIP. Stephen Garrett, still alive. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Garrett, Val Kilmer, RIP. Watch one of his movies or two of his movies or five of his movies when you get a chance. He really was one of a kind as movie actors go. Also, thanks to Sharon Bain for talking to me about funding cuts to American museums under the Trump administration. We'll keep an eye on that story as it moves forward. And thank you to Lonnie Gonzalez for braving the cinematic jungle of a Minecraft movie with her children, and for writing about it for us. A Minecraft movie is the culture now. We all live in the world of a Minecraft movie. We cannot escape it. You must submit. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Book and Film Globe is a subsidiary of Sea of Reeds Media, an independent media company that owns two bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn and the Bookhouse in Long Branch on the Jersey Shore. You can also support those bookstores if you're not in New Jersey by going to bookshop.org and using the Bookhouse as an affiliate link. That is a way, an independent way of buying books online, and we highly support that. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and I will talk to you next week.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.